Your job is to notice when he gets tense and ask, what are you not understanding? What piece are you missing? What piece of information can I bring to help you go be on board with this? And you watch their shoulders drop.
Welcome to the Learn It All podcast with your hosts, Learn It CEO, Damon Lemby, and SVP of Product, Darren Bridget. Our mission is to explore how continuous growth shapes the path to success. Our guests are high achievers who've learned there's always something new to discover. They'll share their stories, strategies, and insights with you. So whether you're a budding entrepreneur, a seasoned executive, an aspiring athlete, or simply someone who believes in the lifelong pursuit of knowledge, this podcast is for you. Join us now for the latest episode as we continue the Learn It All's journey through a world that never stops teaching.
Hello and welcome to the Learn It All podcast. I am Darren Bridget, joined today by my co-host, Damon Lemby. Today's episode poses a fundamental question for anyone on the path to leadership. What are the key skills and mindsets rising leaders need to develop? With the answer, Mark J. Silverman, author of The Rising Leaders Handbook. Mark, it's great to have you here. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm hoping I have the answer.
Yeah. You know, I set you up big and at the end of this episode, the answer will be there for everyone to take in perpetuity. And it is the answer.
Great. Then this will be the last podcast anybody ever does because we fixed
it. Yeah. We're going to fix it. This is it. The be all end all podcast.
Got it.
So welcome. This is a big deal. I'm glad everyone showed up. So maybe to set our sights back a little bit, but also just to get us into the flow of this episode, Mark, can you give us the book jacket version of your story a little bit? You know, how you got here, what you've been working on, how you've been working with leaders. Mark, you're on.
Okay. So the story starts with Mark being homeless and living in his truck, which we talked about before we turned on the mic.
Yeah.
People are always interested in the fact that, you know, I was homeless. I was 135 pounds, had no prospects in life, came to town, and my brother helped me get sober, told me to take some college classes, took some college classes. I had no skills. So outside of the hotel business, I got a job as a sales guy. Because I just didn't want to be in the restaurant business. My whole family was in the restaurant business. I got a job as a sales guy and moved into technology sales. For some strange reason, I was really good at sales. I know in hindsight, it was my people skills. It was my ability to connect. It was my absolute dedication to service that made me successful. But I became wildly successful, made millions of dollars, went from homeless to a Lexus convertible and $1 million house, that kind of thing. The interesting thing was a couple decades later, that all turned on me. I wasn't, you know, the insides didn't match the outside. So the cracks started happening in my marriage. The cracks started happening in my health. The cracks started happening in my career. I couldn't sell anything. And things started to fall apart, kind of like a midlife crisis. And I'm sure you've talked about this on the show before. You know, at some point, what was working doesn't work anymore. And if you don't listen, it's going to blow up and it's going to get your attention. Well, it blew up for me. So my marriage ended, my health was just gone, and my career was in the toilet. And it was then that it was my building myself back from being suicidal and severely depressed that I started to learn different skills. I started to put together a different Mark Silverman. So I started reading every self-help book that was ever written, every spiritual book, you know, just learning how to put back a person, mostly for my family's sake, for my son's sake. I didn't want to leave them a legacy because I didn't really have much passion to go on, but I didn't want to leave them a legacy of failure. And it was that building back that I realized that we have all made an unspoken agreement to be in the 1%. And it was costing us our marriage, our mental health, our well-being. It was just costing us everything to be successful. So when my career did turn around and I started crushing it again and I was building it in a different way, I just couldn't help myself. I was like an ex-smoker, just talking to everybody about how to do things differently. I got admonished by the CEO of one of my companies. It's like, Mark, please stop sending out these newsletters every day about how to live life better, how to do this better. And then I finally, with the help of serendipity, some spirit intervention, became a coach. And now I coach the people who I used to work with to do success in a different fashion.
That's a great story. And, you know, it takes a lot of courage to share that story with everybody. And as I mentioned to you before the show, I read your book over the weekend and I really enjoyed it. How do you define what a rising leader is?
So rising leader for me in my world is someone who has an expertise, is super, super talented, really good at what they do. And then they start rising through the ranks of an organization really quickly. They start rising through the ranks of the organization faster than their maturity level, faster than their leadership skills can keep up with them. So they kind of have the old version of who they were, being the best at what they do, being the best in the room, being the smartest person in the room at any given time. And now their calling is to have success through others. It's to grow other leaders. And that's where the rising leader piece happens. So as they're moving up through the organization, how do we grow them up? How do we give them that maturity and bearing? And how do we give them those skills to lead others rather than do?
And so after somebody goes through your book, you mentioned this earlier, transformation. What is the transformation that you're hoping to inspire them to make after reading your book?
You know, Steve Chandler, who is known kind of as the godfather of coaching and has written about 40 books on self-help and leadership and all that. Yeah, he read my book and he said, you know, Mark, it was really sneaky. You didn't mention anything about transformation or spirituality or growth until halfway through the book. And it was kind of sneaky. The sneaky piece of the book is I use leadership as a means to an end, as a means to personal transformation. I want you to use your relationships, whether it's with your boss, whether it's with your peers, whether it's with the people who work for you or in your personal relationship. I want you to use all those situations to transform yourself, to grow yourself, to become who you can be.
That's great. You know, it's funny listening to you talk about the rising leader thing and you're the smartest person in the room and you're moving really fast, but it's beyond your maturity level. And I'm thinking like, I want to be that person. I want to actually be that person. What if you're not that person? But then I step back and if you're talking about transformation, like I have had that moment and I bet a lot of people have where it's like you're all of a sudden you're succeeding more than you anticipated. And I can picture the exact moment that it happened for me around acting. And I fell apart. I wasn't able to take the speed that I was moving at. I felt that there was just so much light on me that it was then followed up by like one of the darkest periods I had emotionally and mentally. So I guess my point is, I think probably more people have that rising leader experience than even recognize that they do. And dealing with it is how you is. It just applies to a lot of people.
I wrote the book in response to what I do every day, all day. Like I didn't write the book so I could go coach executives who've risen through the ranks. I wrote the book because the book, I didn't plan on writing this book. It was posed to me to write about what I do all day, every day. And I just came after person after person after person who was completely baffled by the fact that the people who worked for them weren't as good as them. Who didn't listen, like they didn't understand that half of your job is being the chief repetitive officer.
Right.
They were just baffled at the fact that people weren't motivated the way they were. Mm-hmm. And how do you, you're now C-level something, VP of something or other. And if you don't know how to get people who aren't like you to do the job you did, you're screwed.
Yeah.
You're going to fail. And it's that gap that I've filled, you know, over and over again. And it's kept me employed, the bull in the China closet and it was fun. It's so fun to be that person. It's so fun to be the top salesperson who nobody's ever going to fire because you're bringing in so much sales, but now you're VP of sales and you're failing.
Yeah.
And they don't want to get rid of you because you're so talented. So how do you close that gap? And that's what the whole Rising Leader program and book is about.
Well, let's get into the book a little bit. And it's great because this is a handbook. You built it to be very actionable for people. And you have this really terrific framework for it. Kind of like I think of it as almost a compass points where you talk about leading up, leading across, leading your team, and then leading yourself. It's such a nice It's like, I know I can orient myself in this world very easily. Can you talk to us a little bit about how you came up with this framework? And then we'll get into each one of them in more detail.
Sure. So I was actually locked in a room by a friend of mine, another coach, who gave me a book of sticky notes. And she said, I want you to take everything you do all day, every day, and I want you to write it on the sticky notes, and you're going to put it on the wall to make sense of what you do every day. And the four perspectives came out really clear. The first thing I do is I teach people to lead up. I teach them to become a trusted advisor, because often I get hired when the CEO is like, this person is driving me crazy. Teach them how to talk to me. Teach them how to bring things, you know, to the leadership team meetings. So that's the first place, is leading up, becoming a trusted advisor. Then I noticed that a lot of these people who are super talented don't play well with other super talented leaders who also have agendas, who also are smart, who also have great ideas, who also want resources, who also have great enrollment skills. How do you, how do you have that co-opetition when you're actually on the team, you're rowing in the same direction, and you want to shine at the same time? So that was totally baffling to people. You know, so sharp elbows was ruining the continuity of the team, but you don't want to kill that spirit. Then leading your team, which is always, you know, the challenge, and there's enough books written on, you know, how do you lead the team and delegate and empower and all that stuff. And then the most important thing for me is, because it all comes down to, how do you lead yourself? How do you become the best version of yourself in every situation you find yourself in? Again, which is the most important thing to me, is, you know, it doesn't really matter how successful you are. You can live on a $100 million yacht and be miserable, or you can sit on a folding chair in a one-bedroom apartment and be content. It's what's going on inside, your experience of life, that matters. And that's what I use all this for, is to help people's experience of life level up.
So kicking it off in the first section of the book is leading up. What I liked right off the bat was you were talking about the importance of eradicating the victim mentality, right? I've also kind of found that in order to be a high performer or a rising leader, you can't really have that victim mentality. So people who want to get there, how do you help them eradicate that?
It's incredible how these go-getters will turn into a victim at the drop of a hat. Because again, think about high school athletes who are just coddled, and you know, you were an athlete, Dan, you know, and then they go to college and they're coddled, and they're like, they're the superstars, and then they go to the majors and they can't get out of the minor leagues. They can't catch a break. They're booed when they go, like, they haven't built that internal fortitude. So when you finally reach that level of incompetence, when you've been so good for so long, often the blame starts showing up. Often the talking about other people, the pulling other people down, the competition, you know, I have to win, so you have to lose kind of thing. Sometimes the thing that have gotten people up the ladder is that win-lose thing rather than win-win-win. So those things start to become really acute the further you go up the ladder. How many C-suite executives have you met who are just the most genuine, cool people? I remember when I was selling to the C-suite, I was always, you know, again, I was poor and I was homeless when I, you know, was younger. So when I was in these, these beautiful executive offices with these people who ran like multinational corporations, and they were gracious and kind and intelligent and thoughtful. When those edges, in order to get there, there's the jerks there, but they're, for the most part, they start to learn how to be with people. They'll start to learn those skills. And that's what I think has to fall off as you rise up through the ranks, if you want to be successful, if you don't want to be the poison pill on a team.
When it comes to leading up, I think there's different ways that I feel like people think about it. You talk about being a trusted advisor, and actually that seems to me like the smartest thing to focus on. But people are also talking about, how do I look good to my boss in that managing up way? How do I influence their decision making and kind of like create the action in the organization that I want to have happen? If you kind of take the big perspective, what is leading up mean in that sense? How do you think people should approach this idea?
Again, you want to be the even keel person in the room. Most CEOs are under so much pressure. Most people who have either built businesses or rise to the level of CEO are a little crazy. You know, they have a lot of energy, let's just say. They have a lot of ideas. They're idea machines. If you think about rocket fuel, visionaries versus implementers, you know, they're visionaries. So they don't want to be held down. So becoming a trusted advisor is working with the personality that you have, right? Not saying they should be different. How many times have I heard, they shouldn't treat me this way. They shouldn't talk this way. They shouldn't throw so many priorities at us. That, no, they should. They're visionaries. It's your job to lead them in a way to understand what the consequences and what the opportunities are of each one of those ideas. So you, if you want to be a trusted advisor, have to go toe-to-toe with your CEO. The only way you can go toe-to-toe with your CEO is if you've earned their trust. How do you earn your trust? You keep your word. You always speak the truth to them, right? You show them that you have their back and the organization's well-being in your, you know, as your primary objective. If I have one CEO who constantly calls me and, you know, will say, you know, this person's out for themselves. They're not out for the company. They're totally out for themselves. He may be right or wrong, but that's his radar. He's always looking for who's out for themselves because they can't be a trusted advisor if he thinks that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. One quick follow-up question to that, because what if you talked about the rocket ship fuel? If you're an implementer and I'm being a trusted advisor to a visionary, that makes pretty good sense to me. But what if I'm more of a visionary myself? How do I create a good relationship with that visionary boss?
If you're a visionary working for a visionary, you have to bring up your implementer. You have to expand your range, right? Which is half of my job is teaching people you're not a finite fixed personality. You're fungible. You were created from childhood. You are created through your young adulthood so you can recreate yourself. So there are times when you have to swallow your ego. You just have to say, this is, you know, the phrase that my clients love is, you know, pick a hill to die on, right? Is this a hill worth dying on? Because everything's important. Everything has to be fixed, but the CEO can't handle that. And nobody's listening to you if you are the shotgun going, we have to fix this and we have to fix this and we have to fix this. Pick a hill. Go in, make your case, right? So we talk about enrollment skills. Enrollment skills or sales skills are the most important skill you can have. Getting people to see your way, getting people to care about your ideas. It's your responsibility. So again, these people who we don't expect them to be victims. I hear all the time. It's like, they don't listen to my ideas. They just, you know, they listen to someone else, or this person plays golf with them, or I'm like, doesn't matter. This is the hand you're dealt. Now play the hand. Now get, you know, if you get turned down, let's up level your enrollment skills. Let's not blame them. That means you need to get better. So those are the kinds of conversations that I have.
So Mark, can you give us an example of how you coach somebody either or yourself on how people could up level their enrollment skills?
That was a really good question. A message just came across my screen. I have a client who's about to be promoted to CEO of this big company. He's second in command now. He's going to be CEO, and his name flashed across, and I have no idea what it says because I'm not reading glasses. I have no idea. So now I'm like, I'm so excited. Like, he either didn't get it or he got it. How do we teach enrollment skills? Think listening first. And so I talk about it in the book. Listening, understanding. Understanding the players, right? Go in and find out what every single person on the leadership team thinks about this particular initiative. What's the pluses to them? What's the minuses to them? What's it going to cost them? How's it going to help them, right? Create your political capital. Are you helping other people, right? When I was a sales guy, whenever I had to go to a C-suite executive, I made sure that I gave, then made an ask. So are you a team member that every single person relies on so that you've built that political capital? So you've got to invest in knowing who the players, knowing what the values are. In the beginning of the book, I do a boss empathy map. In other words, learn what the boss values, learn what their triggers are, learn you know, what's important to them. Do the same thing for the other people on the leadership team. Learn the team, know what's important to them, and then you know how to couch what you're talking about.
I have a selfish question for hopefully because my team is going to be listening, but I think this is great. You talk about this in, again, the first section leading up. How can somebody help their boss become learn how to help their boss become more calm and relaxed?
Oh, it's actually part of my job. I help a lot of CEOs relax through their team. So again, you have to understand. So I do personality testing. I use Enneagram. Other people use DISC. I learn what your boss is, right? Learn what the CEO, what triggers them, what scares them. So I work with one particular CEO who has a temper issue, a wonderful, wonderful person, but just flies off the handle. What we learned is that he flies off the handle when he doesn't understand. If he doesn't understand, if he thinks things are moving too fast and he doesn't understand where people, where this is, the plane's going to land, he loses his shit. So your job is to notice when he gets tense and ask, what are you not understanding? What piece are you missing? What can I bring? What piece of information can I bring to you to help you be on board with this? And you watch their shoulders drop. Each person is different, right? Each person has a different trigger to what makes them, kind of lose it. So, but you become the CEO whisperer when you understand how they tick. By the way, once you're the CEO whisperer, you now have a job for life. And when they go someplace else, they take you with them.
Yeah, that's kind of true, isn't it? It's interesting to hear you talk about all this because it really feels like, I think people imagine showing up with a great leader means that you're passive. They just know what to do and they lead you and you follow and it's easy. But actually, the whole game here, really, as a rising leader, is to focus a lot on help. It's a two-way street. Like, you have to empower that leader to be all that they can be, and that's kind of a big part of your job.
I was hired by a CEO to work with a VP, and the CEO was like, I need him to be a trusted advisor. I need him to challenge me. He's so smart. He's the smartest person in the industry. He's great for the company, but I need a partner in crime, not someone who works for me. So I need you to teach him to speak up, but speak up so that I can hear him. Yeah. Right? I do know I'm difficult, but we created ground rules. We created trigger words. We created all kinds of stuff so that, how would you like me to disagree with you? Yeah. If you'd like me to disagree, what words would help me help you relax into us disagreeing? Michael Bungay Stenier wrote a great book called How to Get Along with Almost Anybody. Right? And it's all about improving relationships. Again, it's learning the person. And then being willing to be the person in that, it's not manipulative. It's not losing yourself to be able to be the person a person needs in a particular situation.
But totally. Well, and it kind of encourages everyone else to be the same. I mean, I hopefully create some reciprocity with your boss as well. So now maybe let's move into this next section, because this next section seems to be really challenging, which is leading across. And I've had people asked me this question before, it's a VP and I need to like give this other VP feedback. And I think you even call this out. This feels like the trickiest dimension to operate in.
It's, how do you lead on a team of other leaders who all have ambitions, who all, it's just a cauldron of competing agendas, right? How do you, start rowing in the same direction? And the number one thing, and Patrick Lencioni talks about this, if there's not trust on a team, you can't move up the hierarchy. You can't conflict well if you haven't created trust. You can't create results if you haven't created trust. So creating trust on the team. And it's one of the things is I teach is it's okay to be the only person who can get along with everybody. It's okay to be that person who the CFO is such a pain in the ass. Nobody gets along with him. I do, right? Like it's okay to be that person. So again, you learn who these people are. It's really hard to hate close up. It's really hard to dislike when you know someone's story. And you learn someone's story. You learn what makes them tick. You learn why their sharp edges are there. Now you have compassion. When you have compassion, now you can create that trust. When you have that trust, now you have allies on the team. So it just takes the extra work to know that that's part of your job. again, that victim mentality is, why do I have to sell to everybody in the organization? Why do I have to be the one to get along with other people? It's because you picked up my book and now you're just a little bit more emotionally intelligent. So now it's your responsibility, right? I'm a coach in my committed relationship. Why do I have to be the emotionally intelligent person in the fight? Because I have the tools, right? So that's part of it.
I love the analogy you use that you're no longer playing golf. You know, now you're playing soccer or basketball, where passing and strategy comes into things. And you see that. And I love Michael Jordan's documentary, and you talk about that. You know, for the first 8 years, whatever it is, he never won, because he was always the best, a hard driver, doing it his own way. But then he was able to, do you think what he was able to do was able to see that other people could add value and do things differently, and he was able to build more trust, and that's why they started winning?
It's totally why he started winning. My friend Devin Bandison, who's he coaches in the NBA, and he told me the story about Michael Jordan, and that's how I got into the book, about the fact that when he went to the Olympics and he had other superstars on his team, he started to learn that he could trust other people in his organization. And that's when they became the dream team. He brought that back to the Bulls. And that's when the game was completely changed for him. He started to understand, you know, Scottie Pippen and Dennis Rodman were going to be total assets to him.
So when it comes to leading across, this idea that, what I'm getting is that you don't have to do it in a vacuum. So someone, well, Darren, you know, or whoever, like, you know, go tell that other VP, I've got some feedback for you. You know, you need to start doing this or doing that. It's like, what you really got to do is you got to create an environment of trust, and then people can cross leadership.
You have to create yourself being a trustworthy person first. You can't create an environment of trust, right? The environment's going to do what the environment's going to do. You can become the trustworthy person. Yeah. You can become the safe place on the leadership team. Then you lead by example.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that, you know, again, you're not going to change the global right away. Yeah. You can't bring in Pat Lencioni's book and say, we need to learn this.
Right. Sure.
You need to learn it. You need to live it. And then other people start to see your success and want to emulate it.
Good. Okay. So that's the answer then. What's just like one or two ideas that if you want to be that person that leads by example when it comes to creating trust, and that's how you lead across. You just become the lightning rod of like, this is a trustworthy person, and it can ripple out. Where do you start? What's the first couple of things that are just good things to
find out what's important to people? Go for coffee. Do not talk about work. You know, find out what's important to people. If they have a charity event, go donate. You donate to my charity event, or you do something nice for my kids, I'm yours forever, right? Like, you know, you contribute to something that's important to me. We now have a bond. So you got to find out what's important to another person, right? Then, you know, you find out that their kid has a gymnastics meet, and they're out of town for. Ask them when they come back, hey, how did it go? Stupid little things like that foster trust. I don't know about you, but the fact that you guys told me that you read my book and you knew leading up, leading across, leading your team and leading yourself, just that, whatever you need, I'm here. I'm in, right? Because you put in a little effort to know who I am.
And on top of that, I agree with you 100%. Just taking, you know, because as a leader, especially, you know, you're jumping from one conversation to the next, but if you could even take 5 seconds to reflect and just ask somebody how they're doing and actually listen to them and not be looking at your phone. I think that's a huge one. And the other one is when you can, and I think you talked about this in your book too, is giving some praise, given, you know, thanking people. I think that one guy said he made 10 calls a day or 10 calls a week or whatever.
Tom Mendoza, who's the former president and chairman of Network Appliance, it was catch someone doing something right. This is the president of a multinational company. And he had people send him notes whenever anybody, a janitor, a salesperson, an executive, anybody did something out of the ordinary. He said, just send me a note. And he would pick up the phone. And he would call, most of the time get voicemail, say, hey, this is Tom Mendoza. And you're like, oh my God, the president of the company. I just heard that, you know, you catered this thing and you did this for this person. Like, oh my God, thank you so much. And now that I have those voicemails to this day, because it meant so much. Someone in power actually cared.
I have a cousin who worked for Disney, and she's got framed in her house an email, a lower level employee she was at Disney, email from Bob Iger thanking her for the contributions that she made to a specific thing. And it goes, I mean, it just takes such a little bit amount of effort to do that. And the recognition just goes so far, and you get people bought in forever for you doing that.
100%.
I almost feel like it's, I don't know if this used to be different or just like, we're just so busy now or something, but I've started actually to tell people, like, let somebody know that you're not going to be there for long. Like grab a cup of coffee and I go by Mark's office and say, Mark, I know you like this kind of coffee. I was at the store. I grabbed next one. I thought I'd just stop by for 5 minutes, say hi. Like literally just call somebody not work related and say, no, I just called to say hi. I got an extra few minutes. So they don't feel like a big obligation, like it's going to take a long time. But every time I do that, people are so, oh, wow, that's so nice. It's like the water cooler stuff that we don't have anymore. People are so appreciative.
So much more important for with the remote offices. It's so much more important to find touch points with your people that isn't in the Brady Bunch square box of a Zoom meeting. You have to get outside of that. You know, one of the things is, can we do a walk and talk?
Yeah.
You know, I need to get some sunshine. You need to get some sunshine. Let's take 15 minutes, grab a cup of coffee, and let's go, you know, take a walk together and talk on the phone.
Now you're talking.
Goes a long way.
We call it the
Truman walks, the Truman walks. We go, you know, because Truman liked to get out and walk and talk. You know, moving over to leading your team, you talk about that it's hard for you to drill this into your young clients. I think you said, you know, that they're not going to survive, they're not going to thrive if they don't learn to create exponential impact from leading their team. Why is it so hard, do you think, especially for young leaders, to realize that the impact you're going to have is going to be less about their work they do and more so about what's going to happen through their team?
How hard is it to change a habit? How hard is it to, you know, like the muscle memory of doing things, the muscle memory of doing things yourself? Then take the other pieces. It's absolutely a shock. It was a shock to me when I remember when I was the first time I was promoted to sales manager. I was promoted to sales manager, so I was selling 1/3 of the time and I was managing 2/3 of the time. And I was still the number one salesperson. And I went into the owner of the company and I said, I don't understand this. Like, what's wrong with these people? Why am I still the number one salesperson? And she was like, well, what do you do that they don't do? And I told her, and she said, teach them that. I was like, oh, okay, that's my job. Not just checking their numbers and going on calls and being in a suit. It's like, well, let's talk about qualifying a lead and things like that. So it's an absolute shock to people that other people aren't motivated. Like, it's just a complete shock that other people care about other things other than their job. And that we talk about it all. And now it's so different because, you know, the economy here in the US is ridiculous. The job market is ridiculous. I work with a lot of government contractors who are trying, like, we could double our business if we could just find people who are willing to go on site and get cleared. Right? We could make some, but we can't find people because they can go live in Miami and work from their balcony on their laptop for $250,000 a year. They're not going to go up to NSA and work in a gray office building. So the competition for those driven people is so high because a lot of those driven people are either being highly paid someplace else or they're leaving the corporate workforce and working for themselves. So you have to develop the people who are working for you, the people who are there. So these skills that we're talking about, these soft skills, these leading from the heart, these, you know, being a vulnerable leader, being a caring leader, it's so important now because you have to nurture the talent that you have.
I agree with that. And we talked a little bit about this backstage, but what are your thoughts on, should everybody look at the career trajectory as going from being a rock star individual contributor to a leader? Because I've seen so many times where somebody would contact me, usually in sales, and say, hey, Damon, I'm so excited. I'm getting promoted into being a leadership. And I'd be like, no, you shouldn't do it. What are your thoughts on that?
well, first of all, sales manager is one of the hardest, worst, thankless jobs on the face of the planet. You go from making, you having your time you be your own, money. Right? And then you go make less money, and then you're accountable for the people above you and below. Like, it's just sales. You only do sales manager if you really want a leadership trajectory someplace, because if you're a stuck sales manager, it's such a hard life. And I'm not knocking it. I'm just saying it's really hard to be squeezed between a bunch of thoroughbreds who, you know, are doing whatever they do, and then your people who want predictable sales results. No, I think it takes a certain personality type. It takes a certain willingness to let go of your ego. Like, your job is no longer to shine. The way you're going to shine is for your people to excel and to get to shift your center of gravity, to work with your ego enough to, you know, put yourself a little bit lower and put everybody else up. The best CEOs work for their people. Right? They're not doormats for their people, but they work for their people. They're basically a Zamboni. They're like, what can I do to make your jobs, to make our company successful, better? Same thing with people who are stepping into leadership. You have to make that actual conscious choice. Okay, I may not get the spotlight. If my people get the spotlight, then I get the spotlight. And that's the way it goes.
I also think, I agree 100% with that. I also think sometimes, especially for new leaders, it takes courage. You kind of sticking your neck out there, because now you're hoping that your team, you know, it's not you out there actually doing the work. You're relying on your team to make you be successful.
You're relying on your team, or you can think of it as your team as your resource to become successful. Right. And you can really think about each individual person. What are their talents? What are their weaknesses? What do they need? How do they need to be motivated? Because everything isn't a nail, so you can't be a hammer. Every single person is motivated differently and has different challenges. And especially again, in this day and age, since COVID, people don't think about work in the same hierarchical order that they used to. Our brains have just been changed. And I think for the better. It just means as a leader, you need to be much more creative in getting results out of your people.
In so many ways, Mark, it feels like the book, as you wrote it, is pointing towards the almost what I feel is like the most important, or maybe even your favorite part of it, which is leading yourself. But you didn't start with that piece.
No.
You started in a different direction, but this is, I mean, everything is, just comes from this beating heartbeat of your model. Can you talk about your decision to do it this way and why this piece, leading yourself, is so important?
I am the only one who thought leading yourself should be last. The person who locked me in the room with the sticky notes said, up until publication date, she's like, you have it all wrong, Mark. I'm like, no, I don't. I do not. This is exactly what's important. Because if I tell you to go work on yourself, I don't know what you do to work on yourself. You got to be out in the world rubbing elbows with people. You've got to put yourself in situations so that, you know, you're called to something. So at the beginning of the book, I talk about Boyd Vardy, who wrote a book called The Lion Tracker's Guide to Life. And he talks about how, you know, when you're out in the bush and there's a lion or a jaguar, you know, 5 feet from you, your nerve endings are standing on end. You know, and surfers talk about being in the surf and like, oh my God, you know, just being alive. Like, yeah, sit in the boardroom, stand in a boardroom and speak your truth. It's different than everybody else in the room. Same thing as the leopard 5 feet from you. Disagree with your CEO. See how you're feeling, right? That's jumping out of a plane without a parachute because you don't know what's going to happen, right? Ask you have a vulnerable conversation with your significant other. You know, oh my God, like that's living. So leading you, once we get to leading you, we've already started seeing how we respond to criticism, where we're triggered. We start to see what our personality types are. We get to leading you. Now we look at the tools of, okay, how do we get ourselves untriggered? How do we ground and center ourselves? My favorite thing in the book is the person who's grounded and centered has the power in any room that they're in. If you're in a room and you see someone who's calm, cool, and collected, they win. My older son, He and I butt heads politically, and like he's so intellectual and thoughtful, and we'll start having an argument, and I'll just end up with just because, and he's like, "What are you getting all upset for, Dad?" I'm like, "Oh, he won again." Like, so if you can stay calm and you can stay grounded and you can stay centered, you can own the room.
You know what I as you're talking about it, what I love about this idea of putting it towards the end is that it emphasizes that the point isn't just you, it's other people. It's like you start with other people, and that's how you test the parameters for how you work on yourself. The other way around feels like, hey, you, more you, let's talk about you. And I feel like we can overdo that so much with just so much focus on yourself.
But Mark, for somebody who happens to get triggered, let's say, and they're not able to be the most grounded person, do you have at least a hack or one step that they should think of first when they're heading into that moment?
So once you're triggered, you're screwed. There's nothing you can do once you're triggered. Your nervous system, your endocrine system, everything has taken over. All you are is along for the ride. You know, just fill my dishwasher wrong and you'll watch me, have to work through my own stuff with, you know, like the plates go this way. I can talk about it all I want, that I shouldn't be upset about the way the dishwasher's loaded, but I am. The thing is to practice beforehand. And I actually have an exercise in the book where it's like visualize yourself getting triggered. Like when you get triggered, do some triage, go do an after action report on what happened, what pothole did you step in, what did you make it mean, and how did you get yourself triggered? Now look in the future. The next time you're in that situation, like, you know, this person is going to take credit for your work. Anticipate it. Work it out with your coach. Work it out with a coworker. Say, hey, you know, when I go into the meeting, you know, Bob is going to take credit for all my work, and I don't want to lose my shit. So you come up with, you know, what are you going to say about that, and how are you going to work on that? Are you going to say something after the meeting? And you just work ahead of time. And what you do is, you know, you see the pothole. You're walking along. You fall in the pothole. You know, then you're walking along. You see the pothole. You fall in it anyway. Because you just habitually, you know, like, I'm not going to react. I'm reacting, right? Then eventually you walk in, you see the pothole, you walk around it. But it just takes practice because your nervous system was created over a long period of time. I say in the book, you know, if you're reacting, if someone's reacting to you or you're reacting to something, anything more than a 4 or 5 to 10, it's no longer the thing. It's childhood trauma. If you're like a 3, you're just a little annoyed. You're a little, you know, that's the thing. But if it goes over a 5, you're shadow boxing with the past and you shouldn't engage with the other person and you shouldn't engage with yourself. So for me, I have learned, especially in political conversations, because my kids used to say, Dad, you know, you're like a Zen master. You're like Dumbledore all the time, except when we talk about politics. Why do you lose your shit during politics? And I'm like, because it scares me. If it touches my fear, I'm going to lose my shit. So I've learned to now say, you know what? I'm scared or I'm triggered. I need a minute. I was having a conversation with my son back in Thanksgiving, and he told me something he wanted to do. And it just froze me in my tracks, terrified me. And he's like, you're mad at me. I'm like, I'm not mad at you. I just need a minute. And we're walking. He goes, you're mad at me. You're so mad at me. I said, dude, I'm not mad at you. I'm scared. So give me a moment to deal with my fear. I was so proud of myself in that moment. And after a couple minutes, I kept breathing. You know, if you breathe in your belly, you wiggle your fingers, you wiggle your toes. If you get pregnant, it'll wash over you and you'll be able to be on the other side. And I couldn't do anything about the trigger, but I could wait it out and not do any damage. And then after about 5 minutes, I just said, okay, what you said to me scared me. Here's why it scared me. I respect you more than any other human being. I believe in you. I want to have a good conversation, but just let's talk dad off the ledge for a while. And we wound up having a great conversation, came to a great decision. And I'm really, but it was so like, there was nothing I was going to do about the fact that the safety of my son triggered me. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's just recognizing that.
That's a great story. It's a good example of everything. Because you talk about preparing for it ahead of time. You talk about all the work that you do on yourself and you still do get triggered. And then you said, you know, because that will happen to people. You, the point isn't just how do I always respond so that I'm like a Zen master in every moment. It's like, no, you'll get triggered. Try to work on it ahead of time. Then when you are triggered, wait it out and don't do any damage. And then you used vulnerability as the lever to pull, which I'm sure you actually had kind of programmed in ahead of time.
Not on this one. This one blindsided me. This was like he said the thing, the one thing, the yeah. only thing that would have triggered me. Yeah. And I was like, oh my God, this is a test.
Is he a teenager?
No, my sons are 23 and 27.
Okay, yeah, but still young enough. Like that's how they do it. That's what they do, and they come around a little bit easier later on. But like they get in that age where it's like they are going to do the thing that's going to.
And what he wanted to do was noble and wonderful sure. and brave and yeah. scared the out of me. Again, you guys are dads. Like,
yeah, yeah, I'm a grandpa now. I get to go through it all again. Okay, I have another question for you. This is super important because it's not in the book. And so people that buy the book, they're not going to get the benefit of this knowledge. And it is one of the biggest contributions, Mark, that you can make to society. And that is secrets to sourdough. What are your secrets to sourdough bread? Because I know this is a big skill for you.
Oh, sourdough bread. So the reason sourdough is so important to me is my brother died last year, a year and a half ago. And it was really tragic, tragic death. And everybody was bringing me bonsais and cookies and kinds of shit. And like nothing made me feel better. I didn't want anything. And everybody's bringing me all this stuff. And it was just annoying. And my rabbi's wife brings me over some soup and some fresh baked sourdough. And I sat at my kitchen. I could cry right now. I sat at my kitchen table with some butter and I tore into that sourdough. And I was like, this is it. This sourdough did the trick. Like it was comfort. Because nothing could comfort me. And I asked her, I said, can I learn to make this? She says, it takes 3 days. I'm like, what? So I went over to her house. She told me, showed me the starter, gave me some of her starter. She taught me how to do it. She gave me her recipe, the 3 days. And I make the best sourdough bread. I don't know why. You throw some everything bagel stuff in there. Great. Throw some rose, like sourdough is. So now whenever someone has a tragedy or someone's having a bad day or someone's, you know, I bake them sourdough. So, and I bring them a sourdough because that's what was done for me. And it just seems to lift people's spirits. I can't eat wheat. I gained 10 pounds after I learned to make sourdough and all my joints started hurting and I started getting inflamed. So I now make sourdough for other people. Yeah. I can't eat it.
My wife is a terrific baker and she would bake bread when we first met. And when it comes out of the oven with like a cube of butter, I just eat the whole thing. I had to ask her, please, you got to stop making so much bread. It's killing me.
I'm right there with you. Mark, I think I saw in your biography, one of the things that you're working on is losing the 10 pounds. Is that one of the things you said you were working on currently?
No, well, that was back then. I did finally get down to the weight I wanted to. It was really bothering me that I'm a coach and I'm disciplined and I can't seem to get these last 6-7 pounds off and get, you know, I'm 62 years old. So it's, you know, it's not easy to drop the weight. And I did, I got to 160. And the very next day that I got to 159 pounds is when I learned to make the sourdough.
It's funny how life works out.
So Marky Mark gained all the weight back. And is now back on the how because my body changed. It's sick, you know, something happened between 60 and 62 that my body completely changed, and everything I did before doesn't work anymore in order to stay thin, and I'm vain as all get out. And I see videos of myself on stage and all that. And I'm working on what foods work for me, you know? And so that's been my food is my biggest challenge, is I don't know how to eat. Every diet, everything I knew how to do before doesn't work now. So that's my current challenge.
I'm right there with you. I mean, I quit drinking 9 years ago as well, you know, and lost a bunch of weight from it. But food is just the biggest challenge. You know, we're almost coming up on time. But before we get to our signature question that we have, is there anything about your book that you want to touch on that maybe Darren and I haven't asked about that would be really beneficial for the listeners before they go out and buy it?
I want them to, you know, anybody who reads the book, I want them to read the book, not so much as a career catapult, but as a means to an end to have a more sustainable, enjoyable life in working. You know, again, freedom is in the ability to have difficult conversations. Freedom is in being able to be honest. And that, I think that's a thing that people find really hard when they feel beholden to a job or a boss or a paycheck. And this gives you a way to get that freedom within those parameters. I want people to be free. Again, you know, that's the whole purpose of everything I do, everything I write, every minute of my life is to help people to be free right here, right now, no matter what their circumstances are.
That's great. Yeah. That's great. So one of our signature questions, you know, Darren already threw it out there, the sour bread, so you can't use that. What is one thing that you can share with our audience that most people are unaware about you, that don't know about you?
Let's see. My guilty pleasure is talent shows. America's Got Talent, The Voice, Britain's Got Talent. Like, I live for auditions. And then I live for watching people grow and shrink as the stage gets bigger. For me, I can feel how much people care, how much they worked for. I'm really inspired by anybody who steps out of their comfort zone and tries something. So for me, talent shows are I cry every morning at these stupid things.
That's great. And you actually start the day with the talent show.
I get on my elliptical and it depends on if it's in a cycle of that. I sit there and then I run upstairs and I'm like, look at this. Oh my God. Oh my God. What? Like, don't you see this?
Yeah. It's great. Well, it is. It's all the hope and to watch people. I mean, you know, I guess I watch the recap ones, but those ones that just totally make you cry, which you don't expect it coming. And then this like little kid busts out with, you know, Janis Joplin or something. Yeah. They're pretty sweet. Well, okay. We said today this would be the one and only podcast. Basically, the end of all podcasts is the one we just did because we answered the question. What do you do if you're an aspiring, if you're a rising leader, what are the skills and mindsets? And I kind of thought, I think it was an ambitious goal, but I feel like we got pretty close. You've got this really great framework that very purposely starts by looking outside yourself before you get to looking at yourself, because it's how you interact with the world and everybody around it, whether it's your boss, your colleagues, or the people that report to you. And you use that as a template for becoming the person that you want to be in service of other people. And if you do it with a certain kind of intention, practice, some discipline, really getting good at focusing on other people, what you get is the benefit of feeling like you're actually helping and making a difference and freedom. So really nice to chat with you today, Mark.
Guys, I appreciate you guys really thorough and great questions. I appreciate this.
Well, we loved having you here. How can our audience get in touch with you?
So markjsilverman.com, mark the letter jsilverman.com. You can get a free copy of Only Tens, my first book, there, and all kinds of free videos and work. Like I just give a whole bunch of stuff away. So there, and I'm on all the socials. You know, there's too many videos of me on Instagram.
And I'm a fan of your podcast too, the Rising Leader podcast. They could check you out there.
Thank you so much. Appreciate that.
Well, Mark, thanks for having you. And for our audience out there, if you enjoyed this episode, share it with a friend, like it. And until next time, stay curious and keep learning. Have a good day, everyone. See ya.
Thanks.
Thanks.